Welcome to Pap Talk, a podcast from Contemporary OBGYN, where we deliver expert insight, commentary, and more on emerging topics and trends for doctors in women's health.
Hello, this is Angie DeRosa, Senior Editor of Contemporary OBGYN. Welcome to our next video interview, which covers gynecologic care considerations for transmasculine people and serves as a support to the article that appears in our August print issue. This population of patients requires very careful consideration when being seen for what may seem like routine gynecological appointments. Transgender and non-binary people face discrimination and stigma, along with other barriers in accessing healthcare services. As two doctors cover in that August print issue, this population needs access to high-quality sexual and reproductive health care. However, given the negative and traumatic experiences they have had, they may avoid necessary care. Take a listen to this interview with expert insight from Dr. Daphna Strumza, who is an OBGYN at the University of Michigan in Ann Arbor, where they also are a clinical lecturer in the Division of Reproductive Endocrinology. Dr. Hallie Christman also is on the interview. She is an OBGYN also at the University of Michigan in Ann Arbor and a second-year family planning fellow and clinical lecturer. Read the story in our print issue as well. Visit us online at contemporaryobgyn.net for more coverage of this issue and other videos. Thank you. So you both addressed in the article that transgender men and non-binary people face so many barriers in accessing quality health care, right? What are some of the other ways I want you both to speak to that healthcare systems can advocate and work toward making sure they have good communication to this population?
I think we need to think on two levels. One is specific barriers that directly impede access to care for transgender people and in general, transmasculine people specifically. Those are insurance exclusions or insurance non-coverage, ways that sometimes providers are either not knowledgeable, and by providers, I include the entire healthcare team, or often directly transphobic. So those direct different things that we can do that we need to fix within the healthcare system. And the second level we need to think about is the kind of structural transphobia that permeates society at large. So the fact that transgender people are much more likely to be unemployed or underemployed, the daily ways in which transgender people face violence and discrimination, especially transgender people of color, transgender women of color, including violence and risk of death. There have been a lot of murders of Black transgender women for a long period of time, but highlighted of the recent past. And these are direct health issues, and they have obviously health consequences. So it is our role as healthcare providers to advocate for them and address kind of systemic change. But certainly within our kind of our more tight boundaries, we have to fix those different issues.
Yeah, I would echo what Dr. Strumza said. And I think within, to speak more to what can be done within the tight boundaries of the healthcare system or within a clinic or health system itself, we need to step back and analyze ways in which our healthcare system, our healthcare intake, our electronic medical records, our training of healthcare providers is cisnormative or normalizes or assumes that all people are cisgender and often assumes heterosexuality as well. And the ways in which that is dangerous to people who are gender diverse in missing or misdiagnosing things or making it feel so they are unable or feel unwelcome in the healthcare system. That can be as simple as having people analyze whether in their healthcare record there's really a way to record sexual and gender minority data information. Are patients just recognized by the legal sex on their insurance card in the healthcare record system, or is their sex assigned at birth and gender identity as well as pronouns recorded? That has huge implications for the care people get, the normal laboratory values that are given back to a clinician, whether an individual may recognize a pregnancy in someone or not. So that has huge implications. Simple things related to visitors or patients entering the healthcare system and the badges that they wear or given the option to wear. Recognition of gender minority people and sexual minority people in advertising campaigns, in publicity in the faculty and staff that is employed by the hospital. So those are all really big things that healthcare systems need to be thinking about. And then down at the clinic level, certainly frontline staff training is really important. And I think we often tend to think about, gosh, we need to better train our docs, or we need to better train our physician assistants, or maybe even our nursing staff people think about. But really, somebody's first interaction with the healthcare system is often that registration staff. Right? And registration staff has, how do they record sex assigned at birth and gender identity? Again, that goes back to systems issues, but also training and understanding of the way a registration staff would handle when somebody discloses that they are trans or non-binary. And how does that get recorded in the system? And what about the security staff at the front door? Do they greet people by saying ma'am or sir, basically assuming a gender identity based on the clothing or the appearance that person has? Or do they use gender neutral language to greet people? What about the cafeteria staff? What about the folks who draw blood in the lab? There are so many people across our healthcare system that really need education. I always say when I'm doing trainings related to providing care for trans and non-binary people, that nobody comes to work on a day and says, you know what I want to do today? I want to like ruffle some feathers and make patients and visitors and families feel uncomfortable. That's what I'm going for today. Nobody says that, but without the proper training, that's what happens. And it's not fair. You would never expect a nurse or a doc or anyone to go in and take a sensitive sexual history without training, right? Or to be able to do any aspect of their job well without the proper training. And yet on so many fronts, we are asking people to go out and provide care without the appropriate training for how to be sensitive to people's gender and how to not be cisnormative and heteronormative. And so we just have a responsibility as a health system to do a better job with that training, and then to really analyze and dig deep and think about the hard questions of how is our system continuing to make cisnormative assumptions, and how can we do better at that?
Also, when it comes down to it's like you said, an entire system, but getting people to think in the mindset requires a concerted effort. And it reminds me of an interview I had last week with Dr. Washington Hill about people of color and how he's working on diversity at his level with his hospital system that does not have a chief diversity officer and doesn't have this mindset. But having to do it at every level and be consciously aware of what needs to occur so that the psychological connection is made. And so you all have to work more thoughtfully with different disciplines within the healthcare system too, right? Depending on what the patient needs are too. Does that require... that also requires a different set of training. Is that correct? Like radiologists that were involved, psychologists?
Absolutely. And I will say there is a particular type of responsibility that lies with physicians, nurses, advanced practitioners, the people who take direct clinical care of patients. And that responsibility is first and foremost to educate ourselves. We would never dream of stepping onto labor and delivery or into the clinic or into the OR without being up to date on guidelines. And those change, and we have to continue educating ourselves. And I think we all have that responsibility as it relates to what we may not have been taught in our training about caring for gender diverse people, or in general, gender and sexual minorities. And so we hope to be able to provide some resources just for that education. And then the kind of, in addition to that, we have the responsibility, acknowledging that the systems we work in are not necessarily where they need to be at the moment, to help coordinate care for patients, whether it be when we send a patient for ultrasound, to make a quick phone call or send a quick message to the ultrasound department saying, this is a transgender man. He uses he, him, his pronouns. Please address him as such. Please confer with him prior to doing a transvaginal ultrasound about his ability to tolerate it. That's a simple, quick interaction that can ensure that the patient has a more positive experience, or whether it be advocating vis-a-vis insurance. And that's one thing that I know Dr. Chrisman and I and many of our colleagues have been struggling with for a long period of time, which is when we perform gender-affirming hysterectomies for our patients, many, many transgender or transmasculine people need a gender-affirming hysterectomy to affirm their gender. And because of antiquated guidelines, insurance companies are often putting on additional barriers by requiring letters from mental health providers prior to authorizing coverage for these surgeries. Letters that they would never ask of a cisgender woman who met criteria for a hysterectomy. And that is a significant barrier, prevents many of the patients we have from getting the care they need. And that is one kind of important front that we need to advocate vis-a-vis.
I wanted to talk about the role of the shared decision-making model, where I wanted to find out from both of you how that really can be used well in working with this population of patients. Would you like to speak to that first, Dr. Struzma?
Yes, it's Strumza.
Sorry.
No worries. Yes. So I struggle with how to call the way I think about this, because we usually use the term shared decision making when there are two options and they're kind of equivalent medically, and we go through a process with a patient of sharing information both ways and finding kind of a solution that, or a pathway that is right for the patient. The same process you refer to is often referred to in the community as the informed consent model. Again, I think a misnomer, because of informed consent is a very specific term. What this, both of these terms try to refer to is the idea that we as practitioners care for our transgender patients in the same ways that we care for every other patient. Meaning that whether they are in our office for initiation of gender-affirming hormones, or whether they're in our office to discuss a hysterectomy, we discuss these issues directly with a patient. We assess what kind of the risk benefit, the alternatives, what the indications are, all those things that we go through with every other patient. As with every other patient, we do kind of a often not completely conscious evaluation of whether the patient has capacity to consent, and rarely, once in a while, with every with kind of every patient population, once in a while we have a patient where we have concern over ability to consent, and we send them to evaluation by a mental health provider. But other than that, that decision making happens between a patient and their provider. And this is in contrast to some of the guidelines, which have certainly historically and contemporaneously as well, either require or strongly suggest that transgender people, before having any gender-affirming procedures or medications, bring a letter from a mental health provider confirming that they are genuinely trans, they are of age of majority, and they have the capacity to give consent, all of which can be determined in the vast majority of cases within the office between the patient and his or her or their physician. And so that is what these models refer to. And I think both Dr. Crisman and I strongly believe that the way to at least start an interaction with a patient is not through mediation of a mental health provider.
Yeah, I would echo that. I think that it is really frustrating to have a conversation with a patient and to mutually decide that it makes sense to move forward with a particular treatment or therapy, and then to have that denied by an insurance company that says, oh yes, we'll eventually cover this, but first we want a patient to jump through the hoops of seeing these mental health providers. And it feels a bit, it delays care. I think it bogs down an already overburdened mental health network. We need our mental health providers to be able to be available to provide mental health care to people who need it. And we already have not enough of those providers. And so to have to use those resources in such an unwise manner in an area where there is no data to suggest that this is a necessary step is really frustrating. I'll just share an experience from this past week where I had a patient whose coverage for their surgery, which was scheduled, was denied in a way that meant the surgery that was already on the books had to be pushed back. And this patient had multiple indications for a hysterectomy, one of which was gender affirming, but they also had severe refractory dysmenorrhea and abnormal bleeding that was not controlled with appropriate dosing of their testosterone. And despite these multiple indications, because gender affirming care was one of the diagnoses, or gender dysphoria was one of the diagnoses listed, this patient's surgery was canceled, and the insurance company said that they would not cover it until there were those two mental health letters. And that's really holding gender diverse people to a different standard than others. In addition to the fact that I think if gender affirming care was the only indication, it is at this point inappropriate to have to involve mental health care providers to have that discussion when a provider has the knowledge and expertise with a patient who ultimately knows their body and their gender better than anyone else, to have to say, gosh, we have to have a mental health provider that meets you for a few hours affirm your gender that you've known your entire life, that feels like it's really just rooted in transphobia and not really in the patient's best interest in any way. It's a huge frustration and takes a lot of Dr. Shimza and my time, yes, as well as many providers, and more importantly, the time, energy, and resources of many patients.
And I will say specifically in these times, I as well have had just in the past week two cases canceled when we're all struggling to make best use of our resources to catch up on our backlogs because of the shutdowns and to get patients who've been already delayed significantly to get them the care they need. At best, the best scenario is that if we spend 2 hours on the phone and a peer-to-peer with insurance company and we kind of manage to reverse those decisions or to appeal them, that is irresponsible use of power and placement of barriers.
And I wanted to go back to something that stood out to me that Dr. Christman mentioned, two letters.
Yeah. And you can imagine, even if somebody has a mental health provider, maybe they're seeing related to depression or anxiety, or maybe somebody they're seeing to help them navigate social stigma related to their family or their workplace. Very few people have two mental health providers that they see on a regular basis. So it really is a checkbox. It's often somebody that someone has to see once or twice, simply for the entire goal of getting a letter from that person. Basically, can you imagine saying, gosh, you know what I have to do today? I have to sit down with someone I've never met and tell them all my experiences with gender dysphoria and prove to them that I am trans enough to get my uterus removed. That's what I have to do today. And you know what? If I fail at that, if I don't prove my case enough, or if this person doesn't think that my symptoms warrant it, then they might not write that letter and I might not be able to get the care I need or deserve. And that is so infuriating. And we're privileged enough to practice in an environment where we have some community mental health providers that have been really supportive and tried to facilitate care for these patients. Yes. But there are many, many people that do not live in that environment. We live in a state where many of our patients can travel 10 or 8 hours to see us from places like the Upper Peninsula, where they may not have easy access to mental health providers or other gender-affirming care providers. And to add that additional burden just feels like really antiquated, not best practices, and a hindrance to the care that our patients need and deserve. And so it's something we're going to continue to fight and advocate for. And I would encourage all of the OBGYNs out there to stick with it with their patients when they need this care, to do those peer-to-peers to help facilitate getting the insurance coverage that patients need, and to continue to be public about this disparity and really unacceptable barrier to care. And I should say that we're focusing a lot on this because I know Dr. Strooms and I, this is a daily frustration for us, but that is not to suggest that this is the only major barrier to care that patients face. A third of trans and non-binary individuals in a large national survey said they delayed seeking healthcare that they needed because they were worried about facing discrimination, violence, harassment in the medical setting. And when you think about people with intersecting minority status, trans people of color, people who have low social resources or economic resources, or maybe live in a rural area, that is only further compounded. So while we are focusing on this as one area of barriers to talk about, it is by no means to say that that's the largest barrier or the only barrier that gender diverse people face in getting adequate and excellent healthcare. It's just one glaring example.
You developed and produced those training modules.
With Dr. Christman, with a large team of collaborators.
What was your main goal? Let's talk about in developing those modules, and what more can the OBGYN community do to find educational resources?
So the goal of the modules was to give OBGYN learners and OBGYN practitioners the basic background knowledge in order to start their journey to learning how to care well for transgender, non-binary, and other gender diverse people. So it's the one-on-one. It starts with some background, some education about OBGYN issues specifically, but gender-affirming hormones in general, medical care and knowledge in general about transgender people. Remembering that not everything related to transgender people is related to their hormones, And then wrapping up with some administrative issues. I have to take the call. I'm going to jump off and leave it to Hallie.
Thank you so much. Thank you.
So Dr. Strumza received a grant through APGO CREAG to develop training videos, in particular that trainees or OBGYNs could use to learn more about providing care for transgender and gender diverse people. And they went about creating bringing together a diverse group of people from across the country with expertise and interest in caring for gender diverse people, and put together this series of modules that a residency could use or an individual practitioner could use as a starting point for a curriculum on improving the OBGYN specific care of trans and gender diverse individuals. And so I would strongly encourage any residents, learners out there, anyone who says, gosh, this is something I need to know more about, to think about using these modules as a launching point. They also do a great job of having some resources incorporated into them for people looking for more information to expand their knowledge or to answer questions that might arise from it. But they're really a wonderful and I think at this point underutilized resource. But certainly I think they're particularly great if you have, let's say, a residency program or a hospital system that says, gosh, we want to do a better job at this, but we don't have a local expert. This would be a wonderful starting point to launch off on.
Yes, that's fantastic. And thank you for all the work you're doing. It seems like you all have a really solid team in place in your region.
Yeah, I would say that we are blessed at Michigan Medicine to have a really supportive OBGYN department that has been incredibly supportive of trying to move forward gender-affirming care. We also have a health system that has a strong gender non-discrimination policy for patients, staff, visitors. That said, we're not perfect and we're constantly discovering ways in which our health system and training system struggle with cisnormativity, struggle with a fixed gender binary that assumes cisgender identity. And so we are certainly not perfect, but I think hospital systems doing things like developing an LGBTQ steering committee as part of their DEI efforts, and having that steering committee engage patients and community members, ideally finding ways to pay or reimburse people for their expertise and time, but certainly engaging community members and staff members across the hospital to figure out where training is lacking. So another video project that I was involved in at Michigan Medicine through a DEI mini grant project.
Okay.
We surveyed about 600 staff members at Michigan Medicine, and 75% of our staff members said that they had never had any formal training in their education in caring for gender diverse people, patients, staff, visitors. And a third of individuals said that they had experienced a situation in their job at Michigan Medicine where they felt unprepared to care for someone that they knew was trans or non-binary. And that was a survey of staff from providers to security staff. And so out of that, we developed a separate set of training modules, videos that are job specific, aimed at a couple job specific titles. So everything from providers to security to clerk and registration, to let people know in the Michigan Medicine system what the expectations are. How do you as a medical assistant, how are you expected to call someone from a waiting room in a way that doesn't accidentally misgender them or put them in a dangerous situation? How do you as a registration staff greet someone on the phone? Or if somebody says to you, actually, use he, him pronouns. How do you record that in our electronic medical record system? And how do you respond to that in a way that isn't transphobic? And so I think as I'm hoping that more health systems can begin to recognize the needs across their health system and begin to employ some of these training modules that exist out there as one small step. I would encourage health systems or providers and practices that have not included gender identity and sexual orientation in their non-discrimination policies to adopt that, particularly in states where that is not already part of civil liberties or civil rights protections.
Wonderful work that you're doing. And the advocacy of it is amazing.
People should not have to move their children out of different school systems or think about relocating in order to feel safe walking down the street or going to see their primary care doctor or their OBGYN. That should be upsetting and disturbing to people that individuals in 2020 would have to do that to feel comfortable. And again, I'll just draw back to the way that that is compounded for people of multiple minority status, and that we can do so much better simply by being compassionate and open-minded and treating people the way that they desire to be treated by using the right names and pronouns. That's such a simple ask and a simple starting point. And if we can all treat, you know, complex gynecologic conditions, if we can manage stat C-sections, we can certainly manage to call people what they need to be called and to respect them and their identity. That is quite a low bar for us to be able to reach, and we can do much more than that. But I would call on the community to really see it as an absolute necessity to reach that bar and far exceed it.
Thanks for listening to this episode of PAP Talk. Subscribe on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you listen.